can't trust a word any of these actors say. Neither the actors in Israel and not the actors in the Western world, in the presidencies, in the chanceries, in the parliaments of the Western world. It's perfectly possible that all of this has been carefully choreographed. We must pray, of course, that there will be a ceasefire, even for a day or a week of relief from the shot and shell of the Western-backed Israeli occupation force, which has laid waste, its grim reaper has now taken the lives and the blood of well over 120,000 people who've either been murdered or maimed, mutilated and wounded. Of course, the United Kingdom is complicit within it. The endless overflights of British aeroplanes, Air Force jets from the bases in Cyprus, the selling of weapons from Britain to Israel, the exchange of intelligence information, where Israel is effectively a sixth eye, the five eyes, the white Anglo-Saxon five eyes that dominate the intelligence world, has long been shared with Israel. And in this last 170 days and more, when the catastrophe has reached the depths that it has reached, the five eyes, the six eyes, have been operating as one. And what a sight it has been. All this death, all this destruction, almost unbearable, even for those only watching it on our telephones, and certainly unbearable for the victims, the Palestinian victims. You know, it's coming up for Easter in the Western world, in the Eastern Christian world. It's a time when we think about resurrection. Will the British government, in some kind of act of epiphany, now mend the great crime that it has committed against the people of Palestine? I'm joined tonight, and in fact every week, with a group of distinguished panelists, as well as an interested live studio audience. Our guest tonight, Low Key, is a rapper, a hip-hop artist, an investigative journalist, and his critically acclaimed music has millions of streams on Spotify, over 25,000 digital downloads, and over 45 million YouTube views. Low Key breaks the ground for independent political music. He's also the host of The Watchdog, a podcast on Mint Press News. Dr. Marwa Osman is a journalist and a presenter. She holds a PhD and two masters and is a university lecturer at the Lebanese International University and Maarif University. She hosts and produces political shows, as well as being a writer, with her comments being published by a whole variety of outlets. And Fra Hughes is a journalist, author, and human rights activist from the north of Ireland. He has written several books, including An Activist's Tale, My Walk with Palestine, which chronicles his experiences as an international activist and his involvement with the Viva Palestina 5 medical aid convoy. His work focuses on the role of activism in promoting justice and human rights. And a plethora of interested and interesting audience guests joining us from all over the world who'll be chipping in throughout the show. But let me turn first, if I may, to my good friend, a sage, a seer, a philosopher king. To say he's a rapper and a hip-hop artist, which he is, and a highly successful one, is not even half the story, as you are about to find out if you haven't seen him before. Low Key, thanks for joining us. I suppose it's the most obvious question in the world. Is the UK complicit in the genocide in Gaza? I know that your answer is the same as mine, Yes, but to what extent and in what ways is the UK complicit in the genocide in Gaza?
Well, thank you so much, George, for the very kind introduction. I'm certainly not worthy of the praise that you heaped upon me. But to start with, it's important that people are aware that Britain has a secret military agreement which it signed with Israel in 2020. We do not know the details of that agreement, but it's very likely that it stipulates some level of involvement if either side officially enter hostilities. What we do know is the R1 shadow spy plane of the Royal Air Force has been flying almost daily over Gaza, and one of the key specialities of that plane is target acquisition. So it would lead you to believe that there has been some involvement on the side of that. We also know that the RAF has sent over 50 military flights to Tel Aviv from the British base in Akrotiri in Cyprus. We also know that around 9 Israeli military jets have landed in this country throughout the bombing of Gaza. We do not know the details of what was on those flights. We know that the US has used the British bases in Cyprus to transport weapons to Israel. We know that Britain, for example, according to Claudia Webb, Member of Parliament, she stated that Britain has granted 26 arms export licenses to Israel during this time. But what we also know is that from the F-35 to the F-16 to the Apache helicopters to even the sniper rifles that Israel uses, they used in 2018 to squash the Great March of Return, where Palestinians were attempting to exercise their right under UN Resolution 194, that even within the sniper rifles, there are components that come from Britain. There are over 100 companies which function in Britain that are involved in the construction of the F-35 fighter jet, which Israel has used to wreak such devastation over Gaza. So really, we are looking at a picture where it's not clear where British intelligence and Israeli intelligence begins and ends on either side. Britain, Israel, and the United States are very much part of a trilateral security arrangement, which sees key functions of the Israelis outsourced to the British, and also vice versa, key functions of the British outsourced to the Israelis. So unfortunately, I would say the answer to your question is definitely.
Thanks for that. We'll come back to you. Let's take a view from Aisha, who's in London, on our audience wall, a new innovation. Very glad to see you, Aisha. You're the first person to speak from that wall. What would you like to ask?
Hi, George. I wanted to ask you, what do you make of this UN resolution? If Israel does follow the ceasefire for the rest of Ramadan, what will it do, or what do you think would happen in the West Bank, knowing what happened last time during the ceasefire, where they simply upped their aggression and the murders and the violence in the West Bank?
Well, I mean, one possibility is that Israel refuses to heed the UN Security Council resolution, and the Security Council is then forced to take a decision about what it will do in response to that defiance. Or Israel will pretend to be accepting the resolution and, as you put it, merely displace their activity, switch the Mardar Incorporated from Gaza to Jerusalem to the West Bank. And what will the Security Council do then? I think that Biden abstaining on the motion is a significant thing. I don't, on balance, believe Israel wanted him to abstain. I think they wanted him to veto it. But time will tell if it's all some macabre dance of death. But the fact that the resolution passed at all, with Britain voting in favor, it's been abstaining for the last 170 days. The fact that Britain voted for a ceasefire is a tribute to each and every protester, demonstrator, boycotter, letters to the editor, everybody who's ever done anything to stand up against this genocide, can take some credit for forcing the British government into the position that it took today. Let me go on to our second guest and introduce her to you, Dr. Marwa Osman, journalist, academic, and activist, presenter on television, and very widely read writer. Dr. Marwa joins us from Lebanon. Dr. Marwa, what's your take on the question we're posing and on the Security Council resolution?
Thank you for having me on your show, George, and condolences to my brothers and sisters in Palestine for the grave loss of human souls this past 6 months. And let me start from your last question and then go to your first. The UN resolution was a bit of something anticipated by many, but a lot suspicious by others as well, like me. I'm very suspicious about how this is going to be implemented in Gaza, whether or not Israel is going to comply with this temporary ceasefire. And I have a lot of questions as to why now, how come the U.S. Decided to abstain from the vote, and what is the result going to be mirrored on the ground, whether the Israeli entity will comply or not, whether they will be sending the delegation to Washington or not. A lot of questions, but especially why now? It's a very big question, and whether or not this is just for show, because if you look at the points in that ceasefire, there some of them are really very hard to implement if you're going to just talk about Israeli captives and not talk about the Palestinian hostages, more than 8,000 Palestinian hostages in Israeli entity detention centers that this resolution did not even mention. So I have a lot of suspicion concerning this and the application of this so-called ceasefire. Now, going back to your first question, whether or not the UK is complicit, I would have to start by saying that today the Minister of Health, the Ministry of Health in Gaza, issued the latest toll of martyrs and injured, and it says that 32,333 Palestinian civilians were murdered by the Zionist entity, and 74,694 have been injured since October 7, 2023. And despite that, the UK government still refuses to suspend its arms transfer to the Zionist Israeli entity. And despite the fact that it knows that UK licensed equipment are being used, have been used, and will most probably be used to carry out genocide, facilitate serious violations of human rights, of international humanitarian law, including war crimes. And they don't really care, despite the fact that it is now complicit, and not, that's not me saying, that's a report by the United Nations, by the, I'm sorry, the Human Rights Watch. They issued a report saying that the current situation places actually the UK government at risk of failing to prevent the genocide. As further than that, it is also being complicit in serious violations of international law, including the violations under Geneva Convention, the Arms Trade Treaty, and domestic laws in the UK itself. And George, for the first time, we have seen UN special rapporteurs saying this, tweeting about this, posting about this, and saying that they have been warning, not from now, since before 2024 entered, that the transfer of the weapons and ammunition that is made by the UK to Zionist Israel is a very heavy violation of international humanitarian law and must stop, and yet the UK government did not stop. Furthermore, it is also complicit in genocide because there are UK citizens, George, who are heavily involved in this act of genocide. Whom can I be referring to? For instance, there's Aryeh Yitzhak King, who's a British citizen and also the deputy mayor of the occupied Al-Quds. He's a UK citizen and he's complicit in genocide. You have the very infamous Ilan Levy, who's from North London, who's also a spokesperson for the Israeli entity government, despite the fact that there were some talk in the past week that he was sacked from that job. You have Peter Lerner, who's also originally from Kenton, Northern London, and he became a very prominent figure in the Israeli entity's occupation army as a lieutenant colonel and a spokesperson. And we have Richard Hecht, who's also a Scottish colonel and a voice in the Israeli entity occupation army. And all of these, if they are not putting the UK government in a complicit position, it pushes us to have serious questions regarding the UK's policies regarding its own citizens participating in genocide and not saying a word about that, despite the fact that they have been arresting and harassing protesters who are just asking and demanding ceasefire. You've also have a lot of complicity when it comes to the UK's role in stopping the fund of the most important UN agency, which is the UNRWA, the UN's relief agency in Gaza. They are complicit in that genocide for pushing, not only stop, but also pushing other states to stop the funding of the UNRWA, despite the fact that there is now starvation, famine in Gaza because of this genocidal war that has been going on since October 7. And added to that, there is a lot of charities working within the UK government's border that have been warning the UK government that they are committing and they are part of facilitating serious violations of humanitarian law, of international humanitarian and humanitarian rights law. They are saying that they are pushing right now for a new wave of activism, asking the public and asking those NGOs who work for aid usually to stop paying taxes for the UK government because it is now complicit in genocide. There's a very important campaign going on in the UK right now called, I think it's called No Tax for Genocide campaign. And it's, by the way, it is completely legal. It's UK officials and part people who are part of the government who are complicit in genocide, or at least who support Zionist Israel, don't have any way in saying that this is illegal or this is this should not be happening or it's a violation of UK domestic law, because there is several legal duties that are included in the 1945 UN Charter and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court and also the Terrorism Act of the year 2000 that give a legal foundation for tax resistance against a government like the UK, who's completely complicit in genocide in Gaza.
Well, it all sounds very much like complicity to me, Dr. Marwa. Thank you very much indeed for that opening statement. Fra Hughes is a man I've traveled to Gaza with on the Viva Palestina sanctions-busting convoys. He's an author and an activist and a regular broadcaster. He's joining us from Ireland. Fra, it won't come as any surprise to you as an Irishman that the British are being rather powerfully accused of being complicit in genocide. What say you?
Absolutely. I agree 100% with everything that's been said so far. We're witnessing the genocide that's happening on the ground right now in real time, in front of our very eyes through social media. I saw a photograph recently which showed a family in Gaza breaking their fast at iftar with water, lemons and grass. Now, George, you'll be well aware of the famine we had in 1847 in Ireland, which was a man-made famine, a weapon of war used by the British to subdue the Irish population and also to end the Irish question in British politics for several generations. The people in Ireland died by the side of the road eating grass. So when I saw that picture, I was quite touched. If I could maybe just for 1 second touch on this UN resolution. Prior to this resolution, the talks taking place in Cairo and different other capitals around the supposed grounds and boundaries for a permanent stroke temporary ceasefire, Hamas was looking for, you know, a minimum of 6 weeks, perhaps going into 6 months, where they would release the Israeli prisoners that they have held under control. What we
I'm afraid that video is breaking up now. Not a great video, but a great, great contribution from Fra Hughes. Let's go back to the video wall and ask Syed Mohsen in London for his point of view.
Well, I listened to the UN output with a keen ear, and nothing's changed. You've got an inept UN, which is basically controlled by the usual global mafia suspects, and they managed to just about after 5 months get essentially 2 weeks of respite for the Palestinians. Now, the reality, I mean, in the short term, I mean, what I wanted to put to you, George, was really to look at what has changed now that we've just seen Israel unveil itself completely. You know, the emperor has no clothes now. There was a time when Zionism was made respectable here, but I think most of the public, even in the West now, understand what's really going on. And there was a time when the two-state solution was the only game in town. And yet it's also being pushed again now by the likes of Biden, etc. They're all still pushing for this two-state solution. But the new reality seems to be that the axis of resistance, of which Hamas and the Islamic Jihad and all the other Palestinian resistance forces are now an integral part, is very much active and alive and has shown itself to be able to resist. How is this going to shape the future of Palestine in terms of what the interests of the Americans are or the Israelis, who by the way, the current ultra-Zionist, ultra-nationalist leadership is also not after any kind of two-state solution. I mean, is the two-state solution ever an option, given that these guys are still now pushing it, or is the one-state solution actually now the most likely one to be put forward by military means?
Thank you to Dr. Marwa, to Fra Hughes, to Loki, our panellists, to all of the studio audience, and my apologies for those of you who didn't get in. Have it out with Galloway. It's been marvellous for me. I hope it was for you. And if it was, come back for Have It Out with Galloway. Come and have a go if you think you're hard enough.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah.
July 12, 1983. Place Hosseinia Jamaran, Tehran. Subject: Revelation of the Teachings and the Truth for More Understanding. If a human being takes a look, even if at this material world around, at this same instrument that are present in the material world, to the volume that this hand has reached it, and the extent that his hand has not reached, there are billions that his hand has not reached. See the language of the Quran, what it commands. We have decorated the nearest heavens to the earth with the decoration of shining stars.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. About the greatness of divine explorations, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, in the name of the humanities, divine goals and philosophical truth, the seeker who has been endowed with a divine nature is diverted and sinks beneath a great veil. This viewpoint of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh revolves around the philosophy and nature of divine exploration and thinking in the creation of universe. You know, man is created as the most beautiful creature on earth. He is given the power of reasoning and insight. He is created as the vicegerent on earth, never to be forsaken by God's ways of guidance. This is so lest man should lose his way, rebel against the will and plan of his Lord, and gradually become puffed up with egotism, self-exaltation, and innumerable superstitions pertaining to his own existence and existence taken as a whole. When these exceptional qualities of man are paired with one's submission to the Creator, Lord, and Cherisher of the worlds, one confidently sets out, providing his worth, evaluating his status over that of the angels in the process. You know that man is bound to comprehend rightly the mission of his creation and purpose of creation, including the creation of his very self. In doing so, man will only be answering the divine call over and over again, reiterated in the Quran, the thrust of which is the meticulous study, exploration, and reflection on the perfectly executed order in the universe's hierarchy. Man's initial impression of amazement with regard to the awesome size in the universe is meant to lead him to an unwavering spiritual awakening, thus promoting all his spiritual and mental faculties to assertively declare, رَبَّنَا مَا خَلَقْتَ هَذَا بَاطِلًا سُبْحَانَكَ فَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ. Our Lord, not for naught has you created all this. Glory to thee. Give us salvation from the testament of the fire. Surah Ali Imran, verse 191. I hope that all of us would follow the teachings and golden points of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, and in that way reach high levels in knowledge and spirituality, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Thousands of foreign nurses are leaving the United Kingdom to work abroad. This has raised fears that Britain is simply a staging post for their careers. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Almost 9,000 foreign nurses a year are leaving the United Kingdom to work abroad, amid a sudden surge in nurses quitting the already understaffed National Health Service for better paid jobs elsewhere. The rise in nurses originally from outside of the European Union moving to take up new posts abroad has prompted concerns that Britain is increasingly becoming a staging post in their careers. The number of UK-registered nurses moving to other countries doubled in just 1 year, between 2021-2022 and 2022-2023, to a record 12,400 cases, and has soared fourfold since before the coronavirus pandemic. 7 out of 10 of those leaving last year, 8,680 individuals, qualified as a nurse somewhere other than the United Kingdom or the European Union, often in India or the Philippines. Many had worked in Britain for up to 3 years, according to research from the Health Foundation. The vast majority of those quitting are heading to the United States, to New Zealand or Australia, where nurses are paid much more than in the United Kingdom, sometimes up to almost double the pay. Experts have voiced their alarm about the findings and said the National Health Service across the United Kingdom, already struggling with about 40,000 vacancies for nurses and hugely reliant on those coming from abroad, is increasingly losing out in the global recruitment race. It feels like the National Health Service is falling down the league table as a destination of choice for overseas nurses, said Dame Anne-Marie Rafferty, a professor of nursing studies at King's College London. Dame Anne-Marie Rafferty added, worryingly, it feels as if the United Kingdom is perceived not as a high but middle-income country in pay terms and as a staging post where nurses from overseas can acclimatise to Western-type health systems in the search for better pay and better working conditions. Last year, 12,400 nurses working in the United Kingdom applied for a Certificate of Current Professional Status, or CCPS, which they need to have to move to work in another country, according to the research foundation, the Health Foundation. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. Thousands of foreign nurses a year are leaving the United Kingdom to find better paid jobs abroad. The surge in nurses originally from outside the European Union moving overseas has prompted fears that Britain is becoming a staging post in their careers. Almost 9,000 foreign nurses a year are leaving Britain to work abroad, amid a sudden surge in nurses quitting the already understaffed National Health Service. Last year, 12,400 nurses working in the United Kingdom applied for a Certificate of Current Professional Status, or CCPS, which they need to have to move to work in another country. The largest increase among that group was in overseas trained nurses who had only worked in the United Kingdom for 3 years or less. That pronounced trend in short stays suggests that for many recruits from abroad, Britain may be just a stepping stone prior to moving to other destinations. The think tank, the Health Foundation, pointed out that the OECD, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, data showed that while a nurse in the United Kingdom earned on average $46,000 a year, substantially less than in Australia, where a nurse can earn up to $71,000, or New Zealand, where a nurse can earn up to $57,000, and the United States, where nurses can earn up to $84,000. Application for a CCPS to work in America rose tenfold between 2021-2022 and 2022-2023, after a change in its visa policy meant many more foreign nurses were able to move there. The Royal College of Nursing said the growing exodus of overseas-trained nurses was due to significant erosion in pay, and nursing profession has suffered since 2010. Professor Pat Cullen, the Royal College of Nursing's chief executive and general secretary, said it is deeply worrying to see more and more overseas nurses choosing to leave Britain. The recruitment of domestic nurses is collapsing, and services are gripped by workforce shortages. With patient needs already going unmet, the prospect of losing more of our international colleagues doesn't bear thinking about, he said. Professor Pat Cullen added, the reality is that sustained attacks on pay and poor working conditions are leaving the UK's healthcare services unable to compete on the world stage. International nurses, like all nurses, have every right to choose to work in countries that better value their skills and expertise. It's no joke that nursing pay in the United Kingdom is joint bottom of 35 OECD countries. The report's co-author, Elaine Kelly, the assistant director at the Health Foundation's Research Centre, said that with an acute nursing shortage and so many overseas nurses quitting the United Kingdom, if the National Health Service is to avoid becoming a stepping stone to careers elsewhere, it needs to be a more attractive place to work for all nurses, regardless of where they were trained. Elaine Kelly added, the brain drain was especially worrying because it cost the National Health Service about £10,000 to replace each foreign recruit who then moved elsewhere. The Department of Health and Social Care said it did not recognise the Health Foundation's figures. The largest nursing and midwifery council data showed fewer nurses, those trained in the United Kingdom and outside of the UK, leaving the National Health Service, according to a spokesperson. We hugely value the care provided by our fantastic nurses, which is why we negotiated a fair and reasonable deal with the trade unions, delivering a 5% pay rise for the nurses, two additional one-off bonuses equivalent to 6% of pay, and a series of non-pay measures to support the NHS workforce in England. The spokesperson added, we also delivered on our commitment to recruit an additional 50,000 NHS nurses 6 months early, and a first ever long-term workforce plan, backed by over £2.4 billion of government funding, will provide the biggest training expansion in the National Health Service history, ensuring that up to 130,000 fewer staff, including nurses, will leave the NHS over the next 15 years.
Questions and answers. In Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Our greetings and salams and respect and salutations, first of all, to the Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi, Ajjalallah ta'ala farajahu sharif, and to you, dear brothers and sisters, who are listening to another episode of the program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to delve a little bit deeper into challenges and problems that you, dear parents, Muslim parents, might have with regards to raising your lovely, dear teenagers. And alhamdulillah, in the studio, we have our dear guest, an expert of the program, Sayyid Salman Naghawi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University. His specialty is Islamic studies. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Okay, so we've been dealing with the issue of hard children that who are very, you know, challenging. You know, you lose your temper with them. You work so many hard, long hours to provide for them, to meet their needs, their financial needs, their material needs. And after all, you're a human being yourself. And it's really hard sometimes to have someone who, you know, and especially children and teenagers these years, that their expectations are so high and they are not thankful. You provide a lot for them, and at the end of the day, they say, I never asked for it. You did it yourself. So, I mean, a lot of we parents do see these things from our children. So in this program, Sayyid Naghawi is going to share with us 7 ways to tackle, you know, these children and to establish a very fruitful, communicative relationship with your teenager. Is that right?
Yes, there's a, for that communication, assertive communication that we were saying, you need to keep your temper, don't lose your temper. But there are 7 steps to that. I mean, as an advice, as you said, that we can seek advice from people who know.
So the points that you're telling us, are they based on Islamic teachings or psychological?
I mean, basically, teachings? When we talk about Islamic teachings, many of them, as we say, are irshadi. They guide us towards what other people, many different experts may understand for themselves. Because sometimes the teachings in Islam are based on some of the human experiences. I mean, whatever human experience, as a result of advancement of the human knowledge and wisdom.
You mean experimental sciences?
Even if, philosophical issues and experimental issues, all of them go, whatever the treasure of human knowledge is that we have today, much of it is endorsed by Islam and its teachings. I mean, many of the things that Islam told us, at that time, maybe it was not easy for us to discover them. Today, we realize that many of the things that were there in the treasure of Islamic teachings is something which human beings can discover, but it will take time.
Right.
So now we need to, you know, we find that all of these things are embedded in Islamic teachings. I mean, when you talk about, when we're going to say here that you need to let your teenager know that you demand respect, you want him to respect you, you respect yourself, something which Islam teaches us, human dignity. So you need to show that we are dignified. We, both of us, are dignified human beings. Human beings are dignified. And dignity has to be respected. Dignity has to be maintained. This is what Islam is telling us. So in the same way.
I just remembered the story where the parent brought their child to the Prophet so that he would, I don't know, name the child or say azan. And the child urinated on the Prophet, and the parents got so angry at that little child. And the Prophet said, no, keep your calm. And I can easily wipe out or wash out this dirty clothes of mine, but the scar that you will leave on the personality or character of your child will never be removed. So this means takrim, or honoring or respecting your child, that starts from much, much before the child is born, and it continues all along until they turn into
exactly.
adults.
So basically, human beings, Islam has come to establish and promote the dignity of mankind, isn't it? So it is basically, karramna bani adam. So if we want to teach our children to be dignified, they need to respect me as a human being also, not for my sake, because Allah has made me a human being, and the child should know that I'm a human being and he is a human being, and that equality has to be maintained. I respect him, he respects me.
Right. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. We're talking about the fact that one of the ways to establish a good connection with your child is to honor them, to respect them in practice.
And to teach them to respect yourself also,
yeah.
Both ways. It should be, number one, respect, setting the boundaries to show this is how you respect me,
mm-hmm.
and show him how to respect yourself.
Do you believe that... you know, some psychologists these days say that if others don't respect you, sometimes it's because you don't respect yourself.
Exactly. That's true. That's true.
I mean, the tricky point.
That is a tricky. I mean, not only it's not allowed to backbite someone behind his back, speak of bad of him behind his back. It's also wrong to be such a person that people talk about you and lift fingers at you, and they make you try to dishonor you. You have to maintain your honor, your dignity yourself. If you are causing people to go behind your back and talk about you in a negative way,
you're to be blamed.
We are ourselves to be blamed. So we need to maintain that dignity in any case, our own dignity and the dignity of our children. And this should be, number two, based on an equal footing. And number three, so number one, dignity. Number two, equality in this dignity. Neither I yell at him or shout at my child, nor does he yell it back at me. We both have to be polite and kind to each other and love each other. But I have to take the lead. I have to show the way. Number three, whatever we say, don't beat behind the bush. Directly,
mm-hmm.
can communicate what you want, what your request is, what you expect from your child.
But at the right time, not when he's angry, true. Hungry, tired.
True, very true. And then you should remain very much focused on what you're saying. Don't go this way and that way. Whatever you want, be focused on it. And keep the doors open for negotiations. Maybe he comes back and says, oh, I don't accept what you're saying. I don't want to do what you're saying. Okay, let's leave it for another day. Let's come back again. If he says or she says, I'm not going to accept what you're saying, then you say, then get lost.
I say, you have to clean your room. I have this problem with my own daughter. Clean your room. For example, she promises to do it, but she never does it. Or she says, I don't want to do it. So
she's a teenager. If she's a teenager, then assert yourself and say, no, this has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to try again and again to make that and, enforce that. And you need to, that negotiation, I mean, you shouldn't break up all your communications. And stop and lose hope in it. No, you need to start again sometime.
Right. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, my dear brothers and sisters in faith. We're talking about 7 steps that you should take in order to make right the relationship or the communication that you have with your teenager. How many points have you mentioned so far?
Number 1, value yourself, dignity, mm-hmm. maintain your dignity. Number 2, promote that in an equal way, on an equal footing between yourself and your child. You should respect him and he should respect you.
Mutual respect.
Number 3, whatever you want to say, it should be directly mentioned.
Don't beat around the bush.
Number 4, it should be focused on one thing that you want to enforce.
Mm-hmm.
And then if there's a pushback, there's some problem, don't let the communication break down. Then you should always maintain that position of calmness. And maintain your cool and say, okay, we'll talk about it another day. But you have to come back to it again to reinforce that. And then you also, when you set a rule and when you set a boundary, you need to also show them, tell them what the consequences will be and follow through with those consequences. For example, you say, oh, if you don't do this, then I will not take you out for a walk. I will not take you out for a movie or whatever reward you wanted to give, mm-hmm. you deprive the child of that reward. Something for breakfast, I will only give you what you want for breakfast if you do this,
mm-hmm.
if you tidy your room, if you whatever. And then if the child is doing what you have asked, then you should praise him or her.
Reward the good job.
Praise is also important. Praise, mm-hmm. not praise. Only rewarding, but also praising.
Praise the person.
And if you don't, things didn't work out as they were planned, then again, you should come back again and say, okay, no problem, we weren't successful this time, let's try again.
Mm-hmm.
So even in case what you expected did not work out, then you need to come back and, you know, try again.
You know, perhaps sometimes some tasks are seen very unmanageable to the child, or it's like the child thinks it's a very hard, difficult thing to do. So you can break it into different pieces and say, okay, so today you can do this part. For example, if it's with regards to cleaning the room, you can, for example, make the bed,
exactly.
and I will help you to put your dirty laundry away. Or, you know, you can offer help, and little by little you can establish that good trait in them by breaking that big one single whole task into different segments or dimensions, and let the child, you know, it's the same way where when we adults have to do something something and we keep postponing it because we think, oh, it's too hard, I'm not going to, you know, you just, you feel it's too difficult to be handled, so you just keep postponing it. But they say, break it down. Just take, for example, just do 5 minutes of the work today, do 10 minutes tomorrow. Once you break it, ultimately, gradually, you'll have the work done.
That's a good way, exactly. That should be the case, and we should be teaching ourselves, educating ourselves and our children. But we need to help them, we need to make them to sort the issues themselves. They need to face the challenges. You need to give them the chance to solve their problems themselves.
Thank you so much. This is the end of another episode of the program Islamic Upbringing. I'm sure a lot of you have a lot of questions to ask, or you have concerns or comments with regards to our program. Feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our social media, Instagram and Facebook, at Call of Islam Radio. And you can listen to our programs at parstoday.ir. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters. 9,650 kHz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Scores more Palestinians are killed in Israel's indiscriminate strikes across Gaza, as the total death toll from